From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Feeling hot, 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 Caribbean nations reject U.S. attempts to punish them for ties with Cuba. As post-apartheid South Africa grapples with reconciliation, the truth emerges about the assassination of a political activist.
And Chris Hani himself, at the time of his death, was, according to at least one or two independent polls, easily the second most popular political figure in our country, of course, after Nelson Mandela.
And a geography whiz kid helps us get our bearings. All this and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Yatrice Lead, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who is on vacation. And now, some of the day's news with Pacifica Radio's Jose Santiago.
And this is Jose Santiago with some of the headlines in the news today. It is now being called the largest recall of meat in United States history. The Arkansas-based Hudson Foods Company has recalled 25 million pounds of ground beef, fearing that it might be infected with potentially deadly E. coli bacteria. The recall is voluntary, although it came after heavy pressure from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, whose inspectors found a number of questionable practices at a meat processing plant in Nebraska, believed to be the source of infected hamburger patties that sickened at least 17 people in Colorado. Federal inspectors reported the plant occasionally added unused meat from one day's production into the next day's production. The plant has now been shut down temporarily, throwing more than 200 employees out of work. In Vermont, a man who earlier this week went on a rampage, fatally shooting four people, then killing himself, has now been found to have worked at one point at a local nuclear power plant. 62-year-old Carl Draga had apparently passed background checks and psychological screenings, and on at least two occasions had worked as a contractor inside the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. On Tuesday, Draga fatally shot two Vermont state troopers, a newspaper editor, and a lawyer with whom he had a long-running dispute. He then turned a gun on himself. A spokesperson for the nuclear plant would not say how Draga had passed the screening process, neither would he release the contents of the background checks. Police in St. Petersburg, Florida, have charged a man with trying to arrange the murder of the Reverend Henry Lyons, the leader of the National Baptist Church. Police say 52-year-old Dale Hutchins was arrested after he offered a man $1,100 to kill Lyons. The Reverend Lyons has been under pressure to resign as leader of the National Baptist Convention USA for alleged financial abuses and problems in his personal life. Police say Hutchins appears to have no connection to the Reverend Lyons other than having read newspaper accounts of the clergyman's troubles. 5 years after the deadly standoff at Ruby Ridge, a county prosecutor in Idaho has charged an FBI sharpshooter with manslaughter and a friend of white separatist Randy Weaver with first-degree murder. FBI agent Lon Horiuchi is charged with firing the bullet that killed Randy Weaver's wife as she stood in a cabin doorway holding a child. Weaver's friend, Kevin Harris, is charged with killing a deputy U.S. Marshal who had come to the cabin to arrest Weaver for failing to show up at a court hearing. The indictments have been called a stunning development in a case that prompted a nationwide debate on the use of force by federal agencies. FBI Director Louis Freeh says he is deeply disappointed. The indictments come several days after a two-year federal investigation ended with no charges against the FBI sharpshooter or several high-ranking FBI officials. The U.S. Congress has authorized the purchase of 21 stealth bombers at a cost of $45 billion, but now a report by the General Accounting Office finds the high-tech airplanes appear to lose their radar-evading capabilities when they are wet. The GAO report says Air Force tests of the plane show its stealth properties are harmed by humidity, rain, or other severe climatic conditions. The report goes on to say that during tests, the plane successfully completed its missions only 26% of the time. Air Force officials cited in the report say that even with design modifications, the problems are not likely to ever be completely corrected. In Chicago, two holdout Teamster locals have finally come to terms with the United Parcel Service, ending a lingering local strike against UPS. A 15-day national strike ended earlier in the week, but the two locals in the Chicago area were bargaining separately and did not reach an agreement until yesterday. The picket lines were coming down today. The company says everyone will be put to work. There will be no layoffs in the Chicago area. And finally, doctors at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta are warning residents of the Northwest to stay away from bats. According to the centers, two elderly men and a young boy from Montana and Washington areas have died from illnesses linked to the rabies virus common in brown bats. And those are some of the headlines topping the news. For Democracy Now!, I'm Jose Santiago.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Eutrice Lead. Leaders of the 15-member Caribbean community have sharply criticized a congressional bid to penalize the group for establishing closer trade links with Cuba. Florida Congresswoman Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, who chairs the House Subcommittee on International Economic Policy and Trade, has introduced legislation that would deny foreign aid and trade privileges to countries that sign free trade agreements with Cuba or permit membership in their trade pacts. Joining us to talk about the controversy is Larry Burns. He is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, a research group on Latin American and Caribbean affairs based in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Larry Burns, for being with us today.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
Very good.
H.R. 2296, as it is surreptitiously called, is aimed at punishing the Caribbean community nations, the CARICOM nations, for maintaining ties or seeking to establish links with Cuba. What is the aim and objective here?
Well, it's very clear what the objective is. The objective is to deliver a punishing blow to the Caribbean English-speaking islands, in this instance, for their burgeoning relationship with Havana. In recent months, there have been visits by five Caribbean prime ministers who have either come to the island or about to come to the island. And almost invariably, once they arrive, like P.J. Patterson or Keith Mitchell of Grenada or Patterson of Jamaica, once they arrive, they condemn Helms-Burton, and they express sympathy with Cuba's economic and political situation, particularly the efforts to isolate the island by Washington diplomacy. And this, of course, is very grating to anti-Castro zealots like the congresswoman. And she comes forth with this rather mischievous piece of legislation, which, ironically enough, the ones who would be most hurt by this legislation would be her home state of Florida, because something like 25% of the $16 billion of trade that the United States carries on, bilateral trade with the Caribbean, emanates from Florida. And I'm sure that business interests in that state will soon be heard from regarding this legislation. Legislation is meant to punish the Caribbean islands economically by cutting off trade benefits and U.S. aid to the island, which in fact in the past 10 years has decreased from $250 million to about $26 million. So we're seeing a 90% decline in U.S. aid to the region over the past decade, but even that rather modest amount would soon be cut off as a result of her legislation.
Already in force is the Helms-Burton law. How does H.R. 2296 differ from Helms-Burton?
Well, of course, it's specifically aimed at the Caribbean islands. It says, and not just the Caribbean islands, it also is aimed at the Central American common market. It is a measure that takes on the growing movement of Cuba to be integrated into the regional organizations. There's an organization, the Association of Caribbean States, ACS, a 25-member nation group that contains the Central American countries, Dominican Republic, and the English-speaking Caribbean, Haiti. Cuba is a charter member of this organization. It also, in 1993, started to be a joined with the CARICOM countries in a sort of a provisional grouping to investigate Cuba's integration in the region. And when Haiti was brought into CARICOM as the first non-English-speaking member several months ago, it was very logical that Cuba would be the next candidate. And in fact, the various prime ministers in their visits to Cuba all stressed Cuba's pending membership in CARICOM. And the legislation that Ross Lehtinen has drafted is very country-specific. It really is aimed at those islands, those countries in the Caribbean Basin, who in any way propose or advance Cuba's membership in regional organizations.
Corrine McKnight joins us now. She is the ambassador of Trinidad and Tobago to the United States. Thank you, Ambassador McKnight, for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me to join with you and have a chat with you.
Well, apparently, thank you. Apparently, you and several other diplomats of CARICOM countries learned of H.R. 2296 in a rather unique way.
That's putting it very nicely indeed. We were invited to coffee, morning coffee, at the on the Hill to discuss the free trade area of the Americas and free trade in general. And we were confronted with a rather lengthy tirade against Cuba by the congresswoman, and this was supported by two of her colleagues, Benjamin Gillian and Diaz-Balart. And at the end of the meeting, with absolutely no discussion of this bill, her aide handed to the Caribbean ambassadors and their representatives copies of the letter and the bill. Now, this was rather surprising to us because, well, at least I felt that if this were the purpose of the meeting, she could have had the transparency of discussing it with us. I would like to just mention something with respect to what Mr. Byrne said, and it is that one of the differences between Helms-Burton and this proposal is that whereas Helms-Burton is addressed to the companies, this is addressed to the governments, with no regard for the fact that these are sovereign governments which must act first and foremost in the interests of their nations and nationals.
Well, I should mention that we invited Congresswoman Ileana Ross Lehtinen to participate in the program, and she has declined. But I'm interested, Ambassador McKnight, in getting an understanding of how her proposed legislation falls within the conventions of international law, specifically as it relates to the World Trade Organization's provisions.
Well, there's a short answer to that, which is it does not. And the long answer is it violates it.
Could you please amplify?
Well, the WTO does not, and no international order allows for one country to unilaterally take measures to punish another country for doing anything, least of all in the area of free trade. This legislation goes further and it discusses a future proposal. It is a threat meant to prevent these governments from doing something which they are not even discussing at the moment. Mr. Burns mentioned that Haiti has been admitted into CARICOM, but so has Suriname. Suriname was actually the first non-English-speaking country to join and become a full member of CARICOM, and Haiti was inducted at the last heads meeting of heads of the Commonwealth CARICOM countries. Now, Cuba was represented at the meeting, but there is no discussion. Dominican Republic is a candidate. Now, I cannot understand how threatening to cut off aid to Caribbean countries, aid which has been diminishing, and to cut off trade, which is largely in favor of the United States. The CARICOM area, the CBI area on the whole, is one of the few areas in the world with which the United States enjoys a trade surplus. Our trade with the United States supports over 300,000 jobs. And of every dollar that the Caribbean earns, both from trading with the United States and from trading elsewhere in the world, at least 60 to 70 cents is spent in the United States on goods, services, equipment, etc. And of that money, between 15 and 20 cents is actually spent in Florida. So I would have thought that a representative of Florida would find it in his or her interest and in the interest of Florida to increase that trade instead of finding ways to decrease it.
Ambassador McKnight, several of the CARICOM countries, in fact 12 so far of the 15, I suppose the others are soon to follow, already have filed an objection to H.R. 2296. What do you anticipate the outcome will be? What has the reaction been so far from the Clinton administration specifically?
No, well, from the Clinton administration, one of his secretaries was in Jamaica, and he expressed some surprise and did not think that the administration would be supporting such a bill because it went contrary to the administration's views on the region. But I would think that given the history of Helms-Burton, our struggle has just started with this. The letters that we have sent in response to Congresswoman Ross Lehtinen, we have not had any response to yet.
Hi. Let me jump in on this. What the ambassador has said has been absolutely well-focused and very accurate. A couple of weeks ago, debated the congresswoman on C-SPAN, and I must say that in my 25 or 30 years in Washington working on these matters, I probably have never come across a person who was less intellectually credible, more muddled in her thinking, absolutely a disgrace to that to Congress. She is a zealot and not a legislator. I mean, she's a single factor sort of person. I mean, really not credible at all. The danger that this legislation poses is not inconsiderable. The administration would like to ignore these kinds of gestures towards Cuba. It has come up with a rather interesting formula where, for example, when the Canadian Foreign Minister, Lloyd Axworthy, went to Cuba and signed some new trade agreements with the island, but spoke to Castro about democracy and human rights matters in a generalized manner, the United States at first criticized Axworthy, but then reversed itself and said that, in fact, his mission to Havana had helped move a discussion of democracy forward. And ever since that phraseology, this has been the consistent way the administration has been greeting these events. You must feel sympathy with the administration because after decades of trying to isolate Cuba, never before has the United States policy been more isolated in the world. And never before has Cuba been more integrated into the world community. We're not just talking about North Korea or Vietnam. We're talking about foreign ministers and prime ministers and trade ministers of almost every European Union country has visited Havana in recent months and announced these new trade agreements.
We have to leave it there, I'm sorry, for the moment. Thank you, Ambassador Corinne McKnight of Trinidad and Tobago. Thank you, Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, for joining us today. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Utrice Lead. South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission has taken up the case of Chris Hani, the popular leader of the South African Communist Party who was assassinated in 1993. The convicted killers, Clive Darby Lewis and Janusz Walus, have applied to the Truth Commission for amnesty. But they must meet certain criteria. For example, they must make full disclosure. They must admit that the act was committed by a known political organization and that the act was not disproportionate to the political aim they sought to achieve. The Hani family and the South African Communist Party are contesting the amnesty bid. Joining us to talk about the case are two guests. George Bizos, a leading human rights lawyer who is representing the family of Chris Hani. He rose to national and international prominence in the early 1960s as one of the attorneys for Nelson Mandela in the infamous Rivonia trial. Jeremy Cronin, the Deputy General Secretary of the South African Communist Party, also joins us. George Bizos, while Clive Darby Lewis and Janusz Walus are seeking a political amnesty through the Truth Commission, it has been reported that one of the assassins, that's Darby Lewis, cited a religious motivation for the crime.
Yes, he did. He contended that he thought that Chris Hani was the Antichrist and that he had a mission to get rid of him. If it is accepted that that was a predominant motive, he will disqualify himself on the ground that that would not be held to have been done on behalf of a known political organization.
How does this Truth and Reconciliation Commission deal with these murky issues, separating strictly political motives from religious motives, even if one might have influenced the other?
It would have to decide what was the predominant motive. But motive is not the only matter. Whether you did it on behalf of a political party, whether it is not disproportionate, are important factors.
In testimony on Monday, Darby Lewis said, "I did it," meaning the murder of Chris Hani, "I did it to strike a blow for Almighty God against the Antichrist, who was Hani in his role as head of the Communist Party." Jeremy Cronin, Deputy General Secretary of the South Africa Communist Party, what was your reaction when that statement was made?
Well, it didn't come as a deep surprise, because here in South Africa, the extreme white right wing, which is distinguished essentially by its racism, has always tried to disguise that racism behind a kind of anti-communism and a pretense that it is furthering the ideals of Western civilization or whatever here in South Africa, and has tried to internationalize its cause by presenting it as anti-communist, as pro-Christian, and so forth. And Darby Lewis, in this case, was simply reaching for that old theme. Of course, it was not just my reaction, but the reaction of a large number of people who are attending on a daily basis this particular hearing. And it was greeted with outrage from the audience of people there. One should just say that although I think in certain instances, perhaps in former Soviet bloc countries, there was a degree of religious intolerance often associated with communism, here in South Africa, we're proud that as a communist party, we number as our members and supporters many religious believers and one or two priests, practicing priests. And immediately following Chris Hani's assassination, there was a tremendous expression of outrage and support from every single religious denomination in South Africa at the huge funeral of Chris Hani back in April 1993. There were speakers from the Muslim faith, the chief rabbi of South Africa spoke in very moving terms and so forth. So that... you know, Clive Darby Lewis, I don't think in invoking that particular theme is convincing too many people.
What was it about the role of the Communist Party in South Africa that so threatened the right wing there?
Well, the South African Communist Party was formed back in the early 1920s, and for most of its existence, it was the only non-racial party in our country. From its very beginning, it was open to people of all races. And I think that this is what has historically irked conservative forces in our country most particularly. As I was saying earlier, in the sort of Cold War period of the 50s and 60s and 1970s, the attempt to prop up apartheid and to defend it was often given a veneer of Cold War rhetoric. By presenting it as essentially an anti-communist struggle as part of a broader Western struggle defending the southern tip of this continent, the African continent, against the sort of red tide. But that was always an alibi for what was essentially defending white racist interests in our country. The influence of the Communist Party has been quite significant, I think particularly in the years of the 1970s and 80s, not independently, but as a major partner of the broader African National Congress movement, of which all South African communists are members. And Chris Hani himself, at the time of his death, was, according to at least one or two independent polls, easily the second most popular political figure in our country, of course, after Nelson Mandela. So the question about popularity, I think, is right, is well-founded. It has been a very popular party amongst the majority of black people in our country.
What role did Chris Hani play in the Communist Party?
At the time of his death, he was the leading official in the Communist Party. He was the general secretary. But for many years, he'd been a leading official within the party. He was also active in the Liberation Army of the ANC, MK as it was called, and it was in that particular role as a soldier that he served with particular distinction in the late 60s, 70s and 80s. But at the time of his death, he'd moved more full-time into work in the South African Communist Party. He was a tireless organizer. I occupied the office next door to him here in Johannesburg in the head offices of the South African Communist Party. And, well, he wasn't there very often because he was moving up and down the country, addressing small meetings and large meetings in the most remote villages of our country. He was that kind of person, someone who engaged easily with ordinary people. And his own background was that he came from one of the poorest parts of rural South Africa.
The two men accused of killing Chris Hani, Janusz Walus and Clive Darby Lewis, both affiliated with the Conservative Party, were said
to have targeted Hani because of his political activities. In fact, reading from the AP report, testifying on the stand on the third day, Clive Darby Lewis apparently asked, "How could I apologize for an act of war? War is war." I go back to you, George Bizos. Was the killing of Chris Hani an act of war?
We will contend that it most certainly was not. The African National Congress had suspended the armed struggle some 3 years before. Jeremy Cronin, in his statement before the Amnesty Committee, annexed the text of numerous statements made by Chris Hani that the only way in which South Africa could solve its problems was by trying to attain peace and to avoid violence. He relies on the fact that there were certain acts committed, particularly against property by way of protest during the period of 3 years or so. He listed them, but he was hard-pressed to show that any one of them were performed by members of the Conservative Party. We do have a disorganized set of people or small groups who have been committing acts of violence or had been committing acts of violence. But the reason why the legislation calls for the act to have been performed on behalf of a known political organization, liberation movement, or a servant of the state in the security services, was in order to exclude people who come into a small cabal and decide for themselves who should live and who should die. Darby Lewis left the Catholic Church because it defied the apartheid government by allowing black children to go into its schools, and went to into a church called the Afrikaner Protestant Church. It has, in a public statement, dissociated itself completely and said that murder in general, and most certainly the murder of Chris Hani, was not performed in accordance with its policy or its direction, and it dissociated itself from Darby Lewis, although there was a sympathetic statement made in relation to him as a person in distress as a result of his conviction and sentence.
No doubt this is a very high-profile case because of the popularity of Chris Hani, but how typical is it of the kinds of testimony the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is receiving?
It is a typical case, but it is receiving very much more attention in the media because of the gravity of the offense committed. And we must remember that the claim made by them was in order to throw the country into chaos and mayhem, to use Darby Lewis's words, so that a chaos may result, from which we deduced that they wanted law and order to break down completely and many people to be killed, in order to achieve a strange objective, that this would open the eyes of the right wing, which would unite in the chaos created, and this would be an opportunity for them to take the gap and take over the government, because they were not prepared to be governed by a black government if the ANC won the election, which at that time was clear to everyone would happen, as it did happen a year later, April 1994.
Jeremy Cronin, I come back to you, of the Communist Party. With the official end of apartheid in South Africa, what now are the concerns of the Communist Party there?
Well, many. Obviously, you're right to say with the official end of apartheid, because apartheid has scarred our society in many respects, social and economic. And apartheid was not just a terrible constitutional dispensation that disenfranchised the majority. It certainly did that. But alongside of that, it has created mass unemployment, massive housing shortage, a terrible crisis when it comes to education. We have an extremely high illiteracy rate, for instance, which is far, far ahead of where much poorer countries, neighbours of ours, find themselves. So we are left with a tremendous backlog and a terrible social and economic legacy as well. And I think that was the message that Chris was carrying into that negotiated transition process. He was saying that the negotiated transition must produce not just a transfer of some powers and privileges to a new elite, but must mark the opening up of a thoroughgoing transformation process. And I think he always spoke with the authority of someone who had been born into a poor migrant family. His mother was not literate. His father was semi-literate and had worked as a migrant laborer on mines. And he kept going back to those roots. And I think he looked at the changing South Africa from that perspective. So those remain our concerns. And we think that since April 1994, and one should add to what George Bezos has said, that it was not accidental that within 1 year and 2 weeks of Chris Hani's assassination, we finally did have the first ever non-racial elections in our country. The right-wingers who assassinated Chris Hani had very much as their agenda, they were not operating in a wartime situation. They were trying to precipitate a new war. The war had ended. There was negotiations. They didn't like that, and they tried to precipitate a new war. And it was only thanks to the leadership of Mandela and other senior leaders in the ANC and South African Communist Party that the assassination did not trigger, in fact, the kind of mayhem and chaos that the assassins had envisaged. And what was done in those complicated and very tense 2 weeks following the assassination was to press home the demand for elections within 1 year. There had been some dithering at the negotiations process, and the huge mass mobilization that occurred following the assassination was used by the ANC and its alliance to insist upon the imperative of elections within 1 year. So in many respects, we say that those elections were a kind of monument to Chris's death. It was tragic that he should die, but his death certainly did ensure that we did have those elections. I think the overwhelming majority of South Africans realized that the country was on the precipice, and that unless there was rapid progress in the negotiations, we would all be engulfed by chaos.
George Bezos, I would like to get an idea of what the next few weeks or months will bring in terms of resolution of the Chris Hani case before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
It will come up again in the last week of November. We will have an opportunity of cross-examining Jalush on what he has stated. He made statements to the police on his arrest which vary substantially from what he is now saying. He is contending, if I may say, in a half-hearted sort of way, that those statements were not freely and voluntarily made. The police officers that took those statements are going to be called, and other witnesses will come to the fore in order to put the matter into perspective so that the evidence of both of them may be contradicted to the effect that they acted alone. A conspiracy to murder has has terms both in relation to the participants in the conspiracy and the victims. We contend that they are being untruthful, both in relation to who the participants in the conspiracy were, and that they are being untruthful when they now contend that they only intended to murder Chris Haney, when in fact a list of names headed by that of the President Nelson Mandela was the top of nine names, particularly or mainly of ANC and South African Communist Party leaders. And according to the statements that they made to the police, that list was a death list. They now contend that that isn't correct. A prerequisite of getting amnesty is that you've got to be truthful about every material aspect of the crime that you have committed. We will contend that they have not done so, and for that and other reasons, their application should be refused.
George Bizos and Jeremy Cronin, thank you for joining us. For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Yutrice Lead. The summer is winding down and students all over the country are getting ready to go back to school. But what will they find once they get there? What subjects will they learn? What will be taught them? Will they be inspired? Will it be an engaging educational experience? Well, we have in studio a very interesting young man, 13-year-old Shei Fayanju. And you know a thing or two about maps, as I'm told.
Yes, I...
You only happen to be the 1996 winner of the National Geography Bee, beating out, I think, how many?
6 million students.
I didn't hear that.
6 million students.
Million, you said?
Yes.
Oh, okay. what do you expect as soon-to-be high school freshman? What do you expect school to be like?
Well, I expect to see lots of my friends coming back, but also some of my friends, they also went off to private school, which is kind of annoying because, I mean, you've been seeing them all through your school, and then now they're leaving, so it's kind of sad. But also I'm expecting a lot of work from my teachers, and because high school is really challenging. It's like a new door that you're opening in your life, so... I'm expecting something new, new change.
Well, let's talk about your great love, being geography. How did you develop this appetite for geography?
When I was 3 years old, my mom bought me an atlas to kind of calm me down because I was always running around the house with nothing to do. So I started remembering the names of the places and the mountains and oceans and other things like that. And I would bug my parents and my siblings, asking them to ask me about what was the capital of Germany or something like that. And I guess that's how my interest in geography started.
And to what use have you put it?
Well, besides winning the National Geography Bee, I'm more aware of the world around me, and it allows me to have a more open outlook towards people from other countries because I know what it's like to live in their country and what life is like, what their religion is, their culture. So it allows one to be more aware of their surroundings and less prejudiced when they know about the people, rather than just having these misconceptions that come out of not knowing about these places.
Speaking of other countries, how does that relate to your own experience?
Well, my parents came here from Nigeria, so unlike many other people, I happen to know what's going on outside of the country, because I mean my parents are from outside this country, so I learned about to respect people from other countries rather than just thinking of them as un-American and thinking of their culture as second rate. I respect them because I really don't like it when people try to downplay people from other countries, because that's like an insult at me and at all the other people who are descendants of immigrants in this country.
And the fact that you've been immersed in geography mm-hmm. means that you literally put yourself into all these different cultures. What do you think, for example, when somebody says, well, I'm Italian-American, what do you know of Italy that helps you appreciate that person?
Well, I know that it has a rich and varied history, that the people are have a long history in the arts and in culture and in seafaring, and they have made a big contribution to American society, and their country is relatively prosperous. So and I know about their food because, well, every American knows about Italian food. But I think that I know more about them because I know about the country and about the language, a little about the people. So it helps me to understand them more.
Could it be that geography then can serve an interesting purpose in the school environment to broaden people's view, other than just saying, well, what's the capital of this country? What's the longitude mm-hmm. of that country? But that through geography, you can really establish ties with people in ways that you would not suspect, learning, say, anthropology or sociology alone.
I think that it definitely helps in dealing with people from other countries, because in many other countries, people take geography class, and it shows, because a few years ago, they had a survey in which they tested Americans and people from about 10 other developed countries, and America ranked nearly, if not last, on the list of the Ooh. Countries, which shows that Americans don't know much about geography, and if you don't know much about geography, you do not know that much about the world and its people. So I think that geography is a very important subject to be taught in school.
Well, let's talk about that, because this happens to be a little grief that you have, a little beef you have to settle with the educational system. I'm talking with Shei Fayanju, the winner of the 1996 National Geography Bee, who won out of just 6 million other competitors. Let's talk about geography and what you wish that schools would do around the country with regard to the subject that you so love.
Well, I think that they should separate social studies, because social studies is basically just an amalgamation of history and geography. So I think that they should separate them into their respective subjects, because then you have a greater focus on each one rather than just losing in combining them. So I think that you should have history and geography class like they used to have, because a few decades ago, I think, even people had history class and then they had their geography class. It wasn't just social studies. But now everything's just kind of mixed up into social studies.
So you want
studies.
It unjumbled.
Yeah.
All by itself.
Yeah.
But you also wanted, do you want to expand it as well, from what I'm told?
Yeah, because geography isn't just the memorization of capitals, because the memorization of capitals is basically just useless trivia. You have to know you can't just know little place names and stuff. You have to learn about the people there, about some of their culture and how they live, because it's better to know that and to apply with other things rather than just knowing names offhand, because that's just rote. But learning the cultures is better. I don't really know how to
really. So yeah. in that, if I were to ask you for an example, using those same principles, what would I know about, say, Mexico that I would not know if I were to go over the old standard definition of geography?
Well, if you went over the old standard geography, you would basically just say Mexico, the capital is Mexico City, it's bordered on the north by United States, it's bordered on the south by blah, 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 it borders this ocean, and its population is blah, 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 blah. I mean, but those are just statistics. You probably wouldn't know that it has a large Native American population, and there's some tensions in there, and some of its products, how its people live, most of them are Roman Catholic, they speak Spanish. It has a pretty high per capita income as compared to other countries, although there are some very rich people and some very poor people. So you also go into current events and news and other things in that field. So
you'll be merging a little anthropology, a little history, a little mm-hmm. of everything, sociology?
Yeah, because many times geography is divided into several fields or more. And even in the geography beat, you have a round called historical geography, you have a round called economic geography, and they usually have a round about current events. So those all have been kind of combined into geography over time. Like, it's expanded to include many other things besides just mountains and place names.
So is your whole life geography, or no? Do you get out and play a little baseball, or what?
Well, I don't really like baseball, but I'm doing cross country now, and that's pretty fun.
Running?
We run lots of miles, so
really?
That's kind of tiring. And then I also hope to do maybe track later this year, and I sometimes like to play basketball or football with friends, and I watch it on TV, I watch shows, and I listen to radio, I go out to the mall, I hang out and stuff.
Beginning to have an eye for the girls?
Yeah, kind of.
Oh, really? That's nice. What are you hoping that you would do as you grow older? What do you think?
I hope to be a doctor when I'm an adult, but I think I would always continue to use geography as a hobby, because I think it's a really fascinating subject to learn about, and I like it a lot.
So as a doctor, what you do when a patient, you have to draw blood, you say, you know, the vein patterns remind me of the Zambezi River.
Well, I wouldn't want to be doing that if I was in the middle of surgery, because they probably think I was crazy, but... I don't know. Maybe.
Let's talk about home life and how it has sustained you and your interest in geography.
Well, I have two loving parents, and I have three siblings, and they're very nice. I have two older and one younger. And the house is a really good place to learn things because, it's not too loud, nor is it too quiet. It's just, a nice tone. And my parents are really helpful, they are really supportive of us, and they are very smart, and so I guess it kind of carried down to us, and they're just really helpful in us. They allow us to watch TV and all these other things, but they also say that, okay, you should spend some time each day learning mm-hmm. something new, which is good, because rather than letting one's mind fry during the summer, you learn to actually pick up a book for once and to learn something.
Yeah. Well, I'm really not... really, I don't know anything, let's just say, about geography. So for a person like me, how would you introduce me to the subject of geography? What would you ask me to do?
Well, I think that first, when you start geography, you do have to learn rote, the memorization of capitals and stuff, because even though it might be boring, the first steps to something are usually, not as much fun as like the later areas. So after you learn that rote, basically you learn that rote, then you can expand into other fields because you'll at least know about where they're talking about rather than just being clueless about.
So
like,
I
what
have to be prepared
about.
That a certain amount is rote learning.
Yeah.
Okay. The capital of the United States is Spokane, Washington. Oh, it's not? Okay. So I have to learn these things. What is the next thing I have to do?
Then after you do that, then you could then. What happened with me is that we bought an encyclopedia around when I was 5 or so, and I really liked that too. And from there, I started learning about history, which led to historical geography. And as time went on, it opened more and more doors because then I learned about economics through the encyclopedia and other things through the encyclopedia. So I guess then you would have to go kind of into. Like looking through encyclopedias, and then you would learn more about other fields of geography. And then eventually you could start learning about, through the encyclopedia, you could learn about the languages of the places and the cultures and all these other things.
So there's hope for me then. I only know 3 things about geography. I know the capital of Trinidad is Port of Spain. I think I know the capital of the United States, which is Washington, D.C. And the third capital I know is Portugal. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Oh, okay,
that's my job. So I could do much better, and I need not fear then.
Mm-hmm. Like I think that Americans sometimes and people in general sometimes think less of their skills than they really have because I mean people aren't stupid. I mean they can learn things. So I think that. I mean, of course, you've heard of Paris and stuff.
Yeah, I was just kidding. I know a little bit about geography. But so, really, compared to you, you know, the way you have methodically gone about it is not the way I have done it. But I'm glad and encouraged that I could do better in geography. But let's turn again. School is coming up. The minute you land, and which high school will you be in?
Verona High School.
Verona High School in New Jersey. Uh-huh. The minute you land in school, would you be advising the social studies department that may I look over your syllabus and see whether it's a good one?
Well, I won't be starting to rouse controversy and getting all the teachers against me, but I hope that as time goes on, they eventually do separate social studies into history and geography because that would be better than just combining it because we don't really do that much geography in school. It's just like on maybe the third day of school. It's, okay, look at this map. This is this. And then no one really cares about it anymore, and they just forget it and throw it away. And, I mean, they should have it as separate subjects so that you can learn more about
them. Now, for these quizzes that you, these national competitions that you participate in, do you cram a particular list of things, or do you know what questions you'll be asked?
Well, the first year, I didn't really know what questions I'd be asked because, well, of course, this is my first year, but, I basically just looked over things from various fields, and I also looked at current events because they usually have lots of things in connection with that, like maybe the final question is about current events or one round is completely about current events. So I think that just learn about everything in general for that.
Shay, it was a delight to have you here with us today, and good luck with high school. For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to reach us via email, our address is democracy@pacifica.org or on the web at www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland engineered from New York. Andy York is our Washington engineer. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Utrice Leeds saying thanks to all of you. Thanks, folks. And come back, Amy. She'll be back on Monday. Thank you for listening.